All right. I think you also know that angels interacted with individuals throughout the Old Testament. For instance, angels announced the birth of significant individuals. Isaac, his birth was announced by an angel. Genesis chapter 18. An angel announced the birth of John the Baptist. Luke chapter 1, verses 11 through 20. An angel announced the birth of Jesus. Matthew chapter 1, verses 20 and following. Luke chapter 1, 26 through 38. Chapter 2, verses 8 through 15. An angel announced Samson's birth in Judges chapter 13. So angels announced the birth of significant people. Angels also protected and cared for the prophets. In 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 5 and following, Elijah is fleeing from Mount Carmel. He's just slain all of Jezebel's prophets and is being pursued, hotly pursued, by Jezebel. Not by her herself, but by those under her command. I guess you'd say her command, although Ahab was the king. It just seems like she was kind of pulling the strings there, wasn't she? He's fleeing and he's running. And he gets tired and he falls asleep. And twice in that passage, he's woken up and commanded by an angel to eat. So God was looking after Elijah. He ends up running all the way down to Mount Horeb, which is also Mount Sinai. So angels were caring for the prophets. You'll recall that angels twice ministered to Jesus. They ministered to him following his temptation. And also an angel strengthened Jesus in the garden. Anything else about angels interacting with individuals? I'm just kind of hitting some highlights here. Yeah, Lewis, go ahead, and then Kenny. Yeah, what I'm suggesting is that the references we see to the angel of the Lord may be the manifestation of Christ before he came to earth in the flesh. So that would go right along with what you're suggesting, if that's the case. If that's the case. Sure. Does that kind of line up with what you're saying? Okay, I thought so. Well, we only know what we're told, and we're told very little, so it's difficult to draw conclusions. Anything else? Yeah, Todd, go ahead. And verse 4 might lend some credence to what you're suggesting as well. For they drank of that spiritual rock that was followed them, and that rock was Christ. So, if I understand what Paul's saying here, is that you have this element of Christ all throughout even the Old Covenant as well. And, of course, all the prophecies are pointing to Jesus, aren't they? The Old Covenant was our tutor to lead us to Christ, to lead the Jews to Christ. So, we can't take Jesus out of the Old Covenant. He's present in many respects, and I think that's what Paul's highlighting there, is that Jesus is present, whether it be symbolically or whether it be in some dimension that we can't comprehend. He was present. If he was the angel of the Lord, if that really was a manifestation of him, that would lend further credence to that. We can't take Jesus out of the Old Covenant, I guess is what I'm saying. Tom, go ahead. No. Sure, and it's like when he said to Nicodemus, and as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. That's a very unusual story. It's a very unusual directive that God gives there. And I think the purpose it was given was to foreshadow Jesus. And so in that sense, he's there. Perhaps not literally, but at least figuratively, pointing toward foreshadowing. Any other thoughts? Very good. Yeah, the angels never acted on their own authority, nor did they speak their own words. They always spoke what they were commanded to speak, and they always acted on their own on the authority of God, not their own authority, which is the exact same thing Jesus did when he came here as well. He never spoke his own words. He only spoke what was given to him by the Father. He never performed these miracles except by the authority that the Father had invested in him. So there's a lot of similarities there.
Are under
Yeah, and we're going to get into that in just a moment. I need to get there quickly because my time is escaping me. I'd like to go over to an really interesting aspect of this. And we've seen angels interact with the nation and with individuals. And I know I've glossed over a lot of really good stuff in this, but I've got to kind of pick and choose what I comment on. Angels are involved as apocalyptic commentators. Now, John talked about the word apocalypse yesterday. It just means an uncovering or a revelation, if you will. And we have at least three apocalyptic books. I guess you might call the book of Ezekiel one as well, perhaps four. You have the book of Daniel, the book of Zechariah, and the book of Revelation, and you could throw Ezekiel into that, I think, as well. Those are books that are very visually driven, are they not? A lot of visions with invested with a great deal of symbolism. And in these apocalyptic books, you have angels as companions of those who were going through the visions. I think John pointed that out yesterday in the book of Zechariah in chapter 1. You also see it in the book of Daniel. In Daniel chapter 7, verses 15 through 16, when Daniel saw the four successive beasts rise out of the great sea, and then saw the Ancient of Days, he goes to one of those who stood by, and he asks, you know, what's going on? He wanted to understand what was going on because these things troubled him. He wanted to know what its interpretation was, and that, I presume, angelic being then explained what the vision meant. In Daniel chapter 8, verses 15 through 19, you might just take a moment to turn there. In Daniel 8, 15 and 9, through 19, Daniel sees a second vision. And this vision is explained by an angel, and we actually have a name assigned to him. Then it happened when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking the meaning, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to the time of the end. Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and stood me upright, and he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. Gabriel goes on to explain the vision that Daniel has just seen, and is told to do so, I presume by God, the voice that tells him, commands him to do this in verse 16. Gabriel is an interesting character, and I was asked to touch on him. As far as I know, Gabriel only appears by name in the book of Daniel, and in the book of Luke. I can't think of any other instances. I don't think I have any other instances listed. Gabriel, as you recall in the book of Luke, announced the birth of John the Baptist and Jesus. I do not believe that this is an arbitrary connection. Let's go over to the 9th chapter of Daniel for a moment. In Daniel chapter 9, verses 20 through 23, Daniel has been speaking and praying. He's been confessing his sin, presenting his supplication before the Lord his God. And as he's speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom he had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, reached me about the time of the evening offering. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. At the beginning of your supplications, the command went out, and I have come to tell you, for you are greatly beloved, and therefore consider the matter and understand the vision. Gabriel goes on to explain a vision that Daniel has seen. This is often called the 70 weeks prophecy. Now, who's the main subject of the 70 weeks prophecy? Yeah, the coming Christ, the Messiah, right? The 70 weeks prophecy predicts the arrival of the Messiah and does so in astonishingly precise and astonishingly precise fashion. It's interesting to me that the angel who was dispatched to explain the 70 weeks prophecy, the 70 weeks vision, is the same angel who appears to announce the birth of who? Jesus and John, for that matter. John and Jesus both. but in particular Jesus. I think there's some nice symmetry here. The very angel who explained a prophecy that predicts the very moment when the Messiah would enter his ministry is the same angel who appeared to Mary to announce his birth. So Gabriel plays a very prominent role in the appearance of Jesus. Gabriel is also the angel, just mentioning this as an aside, who I believe Joseph Smith claims to have seen in his vision. And we'll talk about that more, Lord willing, on Thursday. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, and that's a good point. And there's also an interesting implication there as well. He went out at the beginning of Daniel's prayer, but he arrived after Daniel's prayer was over. It's been suggested, and I think that there's some credibility to this, that angels may be, in some respects, governed by time and space, by physical constraints when they appear to men. Because the command went out, but it took Gabriel some time to get there. Just interesting. Now, later on in the 10th chapter, we may see why it delayed him a little bit. There's some implications that in the angelic realm, there's resisting forces at work. That may be the explanation for why it took Gabriel some time to get to Daniel. But we'll get to that hopefully in just a moment. Any other thoughts? Lewis? There's got to be some purpose to it. I think maybe the purpose here with Gabriel is because of the appearance of Jesus. That's the only conclusion I could come to. It's the same angel who was sent to explain when Jesus would appear is that same angel that appeared to Mary. Is that to give Mary's story some measure of credibility, some divine credibility, if you will? I don't know. Do you have some thoughts on that? That's true. We learn more about angels under the new than we ever knew about them under the old. That's true. That's possible. As Jesus is coming into the world, as that time approaches, he's just opening up more and more about the spiritual realm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think it's very, it resonates a great deal with me that angels are joyful when sinners repent. They are really concerned about the affairs of men. They're interested in that, and they're interested in God's kingdom expanding. Now, they act, as Thomas points out, at the command of God, but there's still some concern that they exhibit. I think that's, at least to me, that's a very comforting thought. Yeah, and they were unable to. But there was a purpose to that. The purpose was so that Christ could come into the world and we would see our need for it. But the angels didn't understand that, because we'll get into a little later on. I want to close this idea of apocalyptic commentators just by pointing out Zechariah 1:9 and following. And then also in the book of Revelation. Throughout the book of Revelation, John has this companion with him at all times as he's seeing this vision unfold. And Revelation 1:1, I think, is important. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, things which must shortly take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John. So the angels were involved in displaying all this, and they comment along the way, and they give some explanation along the way. Now, they're not speaking on their own authority. I believe that they only spoke when God permitted them to speak, and they only spoke what God wanted them to speak. So they had his permission, and they only spoke what was given to them to speak. They didn't speak on their own authority. Anything else as we leave angels under the old covenant? I know I've left a lot of holes here, but I just wasn't sure. If that's what I'm implying, I'm not intending to imply that. What I'm saying is the angels only know what they're told, or what God allows to be revealed through man to them. So I don't know that angels know more than what they say. In fact, I only think they speak what they know. That's at least my impression. Does anybody else have any thoughts about that? Do you have some thoughts, Kenneth? Well, I'd like to take a few minutes to get into this idea of an angelic hierarchy. And we have about 45 minutes. I I think this may be all that we get to. In the New Testament, we're told that there are principalities and powers in both the visible and the invisible realms. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 16, Paul says, "For by him all things were created, that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him." Notice that Paul lists four things: thrones, dominions, principalities, or powers, and these are found in both the visible and invisible realms. So there are hierarchies within the invisible or spiritual realm. In Titus chapter 3, verse 1, Paul says, "Put them in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey magistrates, to be ready for every good work." That's the visible realm. And he's telling Titus to instruct the brethren to obey the government of this world, to obey the local authorities, to obey the imperial authority, and that brethren are to be mindful of these things and not rebel against the authorities that God has put in place in the visible realm. But we also see principalities and powers in the invisible realm, in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 10. "To the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places." Notice that there are principalities and powers in the heavenly or in the spiritual realm. The question I think that often arises: are principalities and powers synonymous with angels? Is what Paul's talking about here synonymous with the angelic realm? Well, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 22, Jesus has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers having been made subject to him. Now, those words are all separated out apart from one another. Authorities is the same word as principalities, if my memory serves me correct. Of course, we have powers. So there the angels are separated out. They're also separated out in Romans chapter 8, verse 38. "For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come." I only bring these passages out because in these passages, the angels are separated from the principalities and powers. And yet, Paul says that there are principalities and powers in the heavenly places. We've got to figure out who he's referring to and how the angels all fit in with this. And this may be a very unsatisfactory presentation because I'm not going to be able to give you a whole lot of structure to all this. Let's just start with what this word principality means. Principalities comes from the Greek word, A-R-C-H-E, I guess that's R-K, and that's Strong 746. Vines defines this word as beginning, government, rule. Theirs, beginning, origin, the person or thing that commences, the first person or thing in a series, the leader. Strong's defines it as a commencement or chief in various applications of order, time, place, or rank. Beginning, corner, at the first, estate, magistrate, power, principality, principal, rule. Bauer, Danker, Arndt, and Gingrich, an authority figure who initiates activity or process, ruler, authority. So the important words, I think, in all this, did you notice how many times beginning came up in those definitions? And first, and some others. Okay? This word power comes from the Greek word, let me spell this, I'm not careful. Oops, already did. Get that right? And that's Strong's 1849. Vines defines this as from the meaning of leave or permission, or liberty of doing as one pleases. It passed to that of the ability or strength with which one is endued, then to that of the power of authority, the right to exercise power. Theirs, power of choice, liberty of doing as one pleases, leave or permission, physical and mental power, the ability or strength with which one is endued, which he either possesses or exercises, the power of authority, influence, and of right, privilege, the power of rule or government. Strong's defines it as privilege, force, capacity, competency, freedom, mastery, delegated influence, authority, jurisdiction, liberty, powers, right, strength. Bauer, Danker, and Gingrich, Art and Gingrich, excuse me, bearing of ruling authority, human authorities, officials, or government. If I understand these two words correctly, principality bears with it the idea of a chief or a head, the first in a series, a being or thing who commences, an authority figure who initiates activity or a process. Whereas powers represent authority, the liberty to direct one's affairs or exercise power, but it also carries with it the idea of delegated or distributed strength or influence. Now, I think that these are perhaps minute differences, but there are some key contrasts between the two. Powers aren't always principalities, but principalities are always powers, if that makes sense. Powers carries with it the idea of being delegated, influence, or authority, whereas principalities are at the head. They're the beginning. They're the first. So a principality could distribute power, but a principality could also receive power from a higher being, from a greater authority. So in that sense, all principalities are powers, but not all powers are principalities. Does that explanation make sense, or is that just a bunch of mumbo-jumbo? Everybody get that? Tom, go ahead.
Well, it makes me think of visible principalities and powers. Mm-hmm. Compare the mayor of Bloomfield to the mayor of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so both mayors, if they have different... The mayor of Bloomfield was on top of the mayor of Bloomfield.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go from there to represent.
Sure. And in fact, there's a great example of this in the 20th chapter of the book of Luke, verse 20. Let's go over there for a moment. Luke chapter 20, verse 20. One of the real challenges with some of these translations is they don't always use the same English word for the same Greek word at all times, so this can get kind of confusing. In Luke chapter 20, verse 20, so they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be righteous that they might seize on his words in order to deliver him to the power and authority of the governor. Now, this word power here is the same Greek word as principality. Okay? So he was delivered to the principality and then also the authority, which is this Greek word for power, exousia. See the real confusion here? I kind of wish they would have walked in there, but they didn't. To me, this is a very interesting way of phrasing this. The power, the principality that Jesus was delivered to was the Roman government, right? That's the power. Who granted Pilate the authority or jurisdiction to administer the justice. When Jesus was delivered to Pilate, he was delivered to the representative of the Roman government, right? But who gave Pilate his power? The Roman government. It wasn't his own, it was delegated, right? Everybody see what I'm saying? So Jesus was delivered to the power, that being the Roman government, and the authority, which is Pilate's, of the government. That distinction makes sense, or am I stretching that a little too far? Everybody see what I'm saying? Okay? Jesus, in John chapter 19, verses 10 and 11, Pilate says to Jesus, are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you? Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." The power to crucify Jesus was Pilate's to administer. But he received that authority from above, first from the Roman government, but ultimately from God, who permitted nations to exercise capital punishment as part of the law that he established after the flood. So that's the distinction I see in all this, is that a principality is the top, it's the beginning. And powers are not always principalities. They are delegated, if you will. Delegated powers, delegated responsibilities, delegated influence. Does that make sense? Everybody with me? Hope I'm not being too obtuse.
And it would seem that Satan would have been one of the higher principalities.